alive and kicking.
On News Talk.
Thanks to NTC.ie, providing professional qualifications in fitness instruction, chronic myofascial pain, neuromuscular therapy, and Pilates. NTC.ie. See who you can be.
And you can text the show on 53106. It'll cost you 30 cents. You can email aliveandkicking@newstalk.com, or you'll find me on Twitter and Instagram. I'm at Claire's Lair. Coming up this morning, I try the boxing fitness class that's frequented by the Pussycat Dolls and supermodels. So I went to see what all the fuss was about. Dr. Harry Barry joins me in studio to discuss the conversations we need to have about suicide. And I'll also be joined by CEO of Breast Cancer Ireland, Aisling Hurley, and cancer survivor, Emer Craig, who on International Women's Day want to empower women to take control of their health and not wait until there's a problem. So what kind of health and wellness week did I have? I have a question for you this morning, although it might be a little bit early considering it's a Sunday morning to ask it. But have you made your bed this morning, or do you make it every morning? I've become a bit obsessed at the moment with morning routines. Now, I don't usually bother to make my bed. Now, to be fair, it's not like I sit drinking cans and smoking cigarettes instead. It's usually I prioritise other things such as tidying the kitchen, putting a wash on, getting the kids out the door, emptying the dishwasher, and all that happens before I inevitably get up to my room, get changed and run out the door. I always make it before I get into it. I would never just pull the duvet over myself, but it may be 5 minutes before I get in that I'm actually making it. And my husband made a comment to me a few weeks back. Now, let's bear in mind, this is the man that thinks if you just pull the duvet up over the unmade bed, that's it made. But that's a discussion for another day. He said something about making your bed in the morning and how it's something that champions do. And then we were both watching something on Netflix recently, and there was a character in that who was a football coach, and he was cleaning footballs, and he saw people looking at him funny, and he said, this is a winner mentality. It doesn't matter that they're going to get dirty again. It doesn't matter that you're going to get into your bed later on that day. If you clean your football, if you make your bed in the morning, that's what champions do. So during the week, on a day that I hadn't made my bed, I must say, I asked my followers on Instagram if they made theirs. And I'd have to say about 98% came back with a very emphatic yes. Sure, there were people like me who said too rushed in the morning, no, don't bother, but not that many. And I felt rather judged. Now, not in a bad way, but as if I was clearly missing something, because people spoke of how it sets them up for the day, that it's a small achievement, but it's starting your day with an achievement. And somebody else said something that really resonated with me. It literally takes 2 minutes. I mean, it's not a long job, is it really? So I was like, why am I not really fitting this in? And there was another follower who alerted me to Tim Ferriss. He is a best-selling author. He has a top-rated podcast. He holds a world record in the tango and is a kickboxing champion. So this guy sets himself goals and achieves them, obviously. And his theory is that what you do first thing in the morning sets you up for the rest of the day. And he has five things on his list. And his number one is to make your bed. Now, he says he learned this from a monk in India, which shows you how wide-reaching this theory is. But this is something that's been held as being of major importance in the Navy for years. So this is a clip from Navy SEAL Commander Admiral William H. McRaven, which is quite the name, who gave a speech to students at the University of Texas in 2014.
If you make your bed every morning, you will have accomplished the first task of the day. It will give you a small sense of pride, and it will encourage you to do another task, and another, and another. And by the end of the day, that one task completed will have turned into many tasks completed. Making your bed will also reinforce the fact that the little things in life matter. If you can't do the little things right, you'll never be able to do the big things right. And if by chance you have a miserable day, you will come home to a bed that is made, that you made. And a made bed gives you encouragement that tomorrow will be better. So if you want to change the world, start off by making your bed.
Seriously simple, isn't it? So back to Tim's list. His first is make the bed. Second is meditate. Third is hang from a bar. So you might remember I spoke to movement coach Pepe Fonte. We had a massive reaction to him a few months back. And he spoke of how transformative hanging from a bar. He said build up to 7 minutes a day, stretched out over the day, a minute here, 30 seconds there, and how important that is for our spine health. So Tim Ferriss is totally on that buzz too, and says you should be doing that or some sort of strength exercise for your core and back. His fourth is to drink a cup of herbal tea. And also to journal is the fifth. And he said that can just be a few bullet points about what you want to get set up for the day or goals you want to achieve, or longer if you feel the need to say more. I also listened this week, I told you I went down a rabbit hole of morning routines, to a podcast with Hal Elrod. He has sold millions of copies of his book, The Miracle Morning, and it's been translated into multiple languages. And his list is fairly similar to Tim's. So I'm into this. I'm intrigued, and I'm going to add it into my 6 month health plan because I really want to see if it does make a difference. Because as of the new year, I told you before, I got rid of my phone beside my bed, which I found was transformative enough to my sleep and to how I was setting up the day without comparing myself to, I don't know, Kim Kardashian and what she's got going on in her life. That nobody needs that at the start of the day. And I've bought a big bean bag to meditate on because clearly you have to buy all the stuff before you start to actually do all the stuff. And I've begun to make my bed. Not every day, not this morning. My husband and my son were still in it, but I will. So let me know where you stand on making your bed. Is it your first achievement of the day? And does it lead to brilliance? So you can text 53106 at a cost of 30 cent, or you can email aliveandkicking@newstalk.com. And yes, I'd have to say it has been a mad week with multiple wall-to-wall discussions of the coronavirus. So I'll just say, wash your hands, try sing happy birthday twice, and try to contain the panic as well as the virus. There's been a lot of discussion around the topic of suicide since the high-profile death of Caroline Flack. So much speculation, so many calling for changes to be made so something like this doesn't happen again. And so many of us wondering what could have been done so it could have been avoided. But it is not just well-known faces who can feel this way in life. The number of people who died by suicide was at its lowest for a century in Ireland last year, but with many cases going unreported and 352 deaths recorded, I know I'm not alone in wishing that that number was zero. Well, Dr. Harry Barry is a GP, a mental health advocate and an author who has dedicated much of his work to looking at this area. And he joins me in studio now. Well, you're very welcome. Well,
thanks very much, Sarah. No.
It is a very big responsibility looking for answers in darkness like this, but it is such important work that you do.
Yeah, I think this is something that I think all of us, every person in society has a role here. You know, we weren't trying to say this is simply the role of, you know, people in the therapeutic area. But we all have a duty of care to look after each other. And we all need to be more observant when, you know, friends or colleagues or people we know don't seem to be in a good space. And a very good initiative going on, I think it's in the Netherlands, where they're actually trying to teach people to ask a very, very important question, a very simple question. You know, if you think somebody is not in a good space, to simply ask the question, you know, have you thought of harming yourself? Have you thought of doing something? And it's amazing the responses that you'll get to that question, you know, because some people are very relieved, maybe they're distressed, maybe they're in a bad place. And it's a kind of a relief to be able to suddenly open up and talk about this. And, you know, once a person opens up, at least then you're in a position to say, well, have you thought of, the second important question is, well, have you thought about how you would do it? And the person who has clear plans obviously is somebody who really needs help, and you need to stay with and work with that person till you get them to the appropriate help. But I think why I purposely started, by the way, with our own personal things, because I think if we're going to resolve this, it's not going to be resolved by big structures. It's not going to be resolved by major therapeutic interventions. Obviously, these are really important and they play a key role. But it's probably going to be most defeated, really, when we as a society, you know, get rid of the stigma of suicide and begin to kind of say, look, you know, all of us can reach places at times in our lives where we're very low, where maybe things are going very badly in our lives, where we see no other way out. And it's the ability to be able to open up and talk about those things and go for help that is seriously going to dent those figures.
Because even I balked when you said that, because I thought your question was going to be, you know, how are you? Are you okay? But of course, we all know, especially here in Ireland, you just say grand. You never really get to the surface. But to picture myself with work colleagues in the kitchenette saying, have you ever thought about harming yourself?
Yeah.
But you think the more we start talking about these things, the more the stigma goes away,
exactly.
And the more people
will ask
for help.
Yeah, I think it's very interesting. The person who's in charge of that, approach in Holland, gave a talk that I was at. And I was very impressed by how much they're beginning to accept it in amongst the public. You know, it's becoming more and more accepted. Now, we're not talking, you're obviously not going to go around and ask that question to every person, you know, but I'm saying if you know somebody, if you know a colleague, you know they're in a bad place, you feel they're maybe very down, you know they're having major problems, to maybe gently introduce the subject, you know, you don't seem to be in a good place, and there's no point in asking somebody how you are. It's much more, you don't seem to be yourself, you don't seem to be in a good place, you know, I've been a bit concerned about you, you know, have you had any of these ideas or thoughts? And you'd be amazed how somebody might say, you know, you're the first person that's noticed, you're the first person that's, you know, asked me really how I am. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And maybe they might open up. Now, I'm not saying they will, do you know what I mean? But at least you have done your piece.
And it may take more than one attempt.
Yes.
But yeah,
yes.
Open the door.
Yes.
I think what really interests me in you, not only are you an excellent talker and writer on the topic, but you look at not only the mental health issues, but also the neurobiology of what's going on in the brain. So what are the common occurrences?
Yeah, it's very interesting. I've always been fascinated by the neurobiology, and suicide is like, there's lots and lots of things going on in the body, which tells us that the person is under significant stress for a considerable period of time. For example, the adrenal gland, which is our stress gland in the body, in some cases of suicide has shown to be almost doubled in size. So in other words, there's evidence immediately here of huge stress. We can see evidence of increased stress peptides in the brain. Do you know what I mean? So we can nearly, to a certain extent, unfortunately, in some cases this is done maybe when the person is dead. Do you know what I mean? But we can actually see clear evidence that the person's stress system, and when the person's stress system gets into trouble, we pump out piles of cortisol and stress peptides. And they, of course, zap the brain, which bring down our mood further. So it's like a self-defeating prophecy. Do you know what I mean? I think from what you've got to do then, you've got to balance the neurobiology, then what's going on in the person's life. Do you know what I mean? So you very often find that suicide occurs. Very interesting definition of suicide that we never actually listen to, but it's the reach out correct definition of suicide. We die by suicide when we try to resolve a problem that we feel is unsolvable by any other means. That's a very interesting definition, because we're inclined to medicalize this completely. Do you know what I mean? We're inclined to say, well, there must be some very serious mental health illness, do you know what I mean, or difficulty for a person to reach the point where they take their own lives. But if you actually look at that definition, It actually covers a wide spectrum of emotional distress. So it might be a mental illness. It could be severe depression or bipolar or possibly early schizophrenia. It could be somebody who's a major addiction issues, who's reached the end of the line. But there will be many, many people out there who will be emotionally distressed for all kinds of different reasons. It could be a relationship, critical relationship breaking down. It could be financial difficulties, which is a critical one for many people. It might be at the end of a long series of difficult things happening in their lives, maybe losses. So all those things can come together to cause emotional distress. And I would prefer that we move to the model of thinking of suicide as the response to severe emotional distress, because therein opens up a whole new world of. And that fits with the neurobiological thing, you know, because when we look at all the neurobiological signs, it fits. This person is incredibly stressed because they're struggling to cope with all these particular difficulties, whatever those difficulties happen to be, whether they're mental illness or whether they're life crisis situations or a mixture of both.
And even when you give that definition and the word problem is in there, I mean, that takes it out of the person.
It's
something that's going on. It's not them.
Exactly.
And Eckhart Tolle speaks fascinatingly about this, because he contemplated suicide himself. And he just said to himself, I can't live with myself anymore. And then he said, well, why am I saying I and myself? That's not two people.
Absolutely.
I'm one person. These are only my thoughts.
These are
and
my
that
thoughts.
Transformed
he's
life.
Absolutely correct. I think the next, you know, if we take that model of emotion distress, though, now we have to turn our psychotherapeutic mind and go in on the person. What's really going on in their mind? And I'm really very interested in this. And I've talked to, you know, quite a number of people over the years who've struggled in these areas. And it's always your internal ruminations that are actually causing the problem. So what we have is suicide happens when we have this internal, incredibly self-critical thing going on, that you feel and also this catastrophizing. You know, it's almost that this is a hopeless situation. I am a hopeless person. I am the problem. Do you know what I mean? It usually moves from whatever the issue was to I'm the problem. So if, for example, I've made a major financial problem, it's not that I made a major financial mistake. It's no, that I am stupid, I'm useless, I'm worthless. You know, the world would really be better off without me. So it's kind of moving into that level of rumination. And I think what we sometimes fail to grasp is that emotional pain is incredibly distressing. So this continuous barrage going on in my mind creates enormous emotional pain. And emotional pain is very, very distressing for the person. So imagine, I often talk about the suicide cocoon. Do you know that a number
the
of people
theory, yes.
yeah, go into the cocoon? So in other words, I might decide, you know, I can't take it anymore. So sometime over the next week or a fortnight or whatever, I'm going to do something. And I maybe start making plans about how I'm going to do that. And I've actually seen situations where people have planned maybe months in advance. Do you know what I mean? You can actually see evidence of planning way, way ahead. Sometimes it's a spur of the moment. Sometimes it's just maybe the person drinks. Do you know what I mean? And of course, another key issue in suicide is we know that a percentage of people who die by suicide will have alcohol taken either on the day or several days beforehand, sometimes in maybe large amounts. And that's important because alcohol is a very strong depressant. So it brings down our mood. So suppose we're really struggling with emotion distress and we're having a lot of these ruminatory thoughts. We drink and we get a kind of a temporary release. But then immediately that level falls, we fall deeper into a kind of depressed kind of state. And of course, the more we do that, the more likely we are to do something. But I suppose you had a pain in your stomach and the surgeon said, you know, I'm operating you next Monday at 10 o'clock. Well, you may brighten up immediately and say, geez, at least, you know, I can cope with that.
And often the pain nearly goes away.
The pain nearly clears.
Yeah, yeah.
And how often do you hear people say, you know, it was like if the person was in great humour, they were planning, and but all they're doing is actually making sure that those around them have no knowledge as to what they actually plan to do, because they've gone into this almost thinking straight where they've focused in on this is the only way of solving the problem.
And they don't have to think about continuing anymore
yes.
because they've decided the end. But you've learned a huge amount from speaking to people who have contemplated suicide
yes.
or attempted suicide
yes.
and lived. So
yes.
what do they say?
Well, I think the good news for anybody listening out there, what most of them will say is that from a practical point of view, most people in my experience, the vast majority, are very happy that it wasn't successful. You know, so suppose it was a serious attempt and it survived. Because many of them, maybe it shocks them out of them a little bit, and maybe there's an opportunity for services or the person themselves or family or psychotherapy services preferably to help them to try to resolve what is the problem. Do you know, in other words, what was the basic problem that you thought was unresolvable? If it was a depression, we'll maybe try and get the person to get some help. If it was a life situation, we'll get help in those areas. And amazing the number of people who said, you know, I'm so happy now that I wasn't successful. And I had nearly wrapped myself in a cocoon. I'd nearly closed down all other bits of information coming in. And when I had the opportunity following a serious suicide attempt to actually do something about it, you know, so many of them will move on their lives and actually will actually be often champions then of saying,
yeah.
look, you know, there are other ways, you know. But
yeah.
it's unfortunately, sometimes when we get into this state of mind, we nearly close down everything else. It's like we go into this cocoon and we shut down all other information. So I think certainly if we're talking to the individual person, this is the only way to go. We've got to get into their heads. You've got to get into the mind of the person. There is no other way.
And what do we need to do day to day so that we're fortified against the stresses that will inevitably come, whether it's an outside force like financial that you mentioned or loss in life personally through a breakup or death? What do we need to do so that we have the resilience to come through all of those things rather than let them tear us down?
I think this is really the secret. And I think as a society, you know, I do worry a little bit that our resilience, particularly amongst our younger people, do you know what I mean, is definitely reducing. So I do think one of the great skills is to stop this rating game. Do you know what I mean? Like, social media, unfortunately, is playing a huge role in this. Do you know what I mean? Social media is almost convincing us that human beings are almost items or commodities that can be basically measured against one another. So it's like, if you know, depending on how well I seem to be doing in some area of my life in terms of social media, I either think I'm brilliant or I think I'm useless. So we need to become much more realistic and see social media for what it is. It's basically a tool set up by very wealthy guys to make even more money because they want us to compare our lives one versus the other.
Yeah, so get in, enjoy it, but don't let it control you. You have a brilliant book on this, Flagging the Screenager, Guiding Your Child Through Adolescence and Young Adulthood. But I think there's lessons for all of us. I'm going to read a very small part from it. We have to learn that life is unfair, that we don't always get what we want, to accept discomfort is a part of life, that we can't control life, and that we may fail at something in life, but we are never ourselves failures. You have so many lessons for us to learn.
These were messages that I think were particularly done in two other books, Emotion Resilience, which really does this in detail because it actually tells you what to do. In other words, how do you develop the skill, for example, to accept that life is unfair? How do you deal with problem solving? How do you cope with the whole world of rating? And then Unconditioned Self-Acceptance, which was my last book, was really tearing apart this whole world of rating and trying to get to see, look, we must all regard ourselves as the special, wonderful, unique human beings that we are. And if we want to compare anything, we're quite free to compare our behaviour, what we do, our skills, our talents, any of those things. But us ourselves, that internal, wonderful person that is us, that's off limits.
Dr. Harry Barry, I adore the work that you're doing. Thank you very, very much. And if you're affected by anything discussed in that interview, talk to someone. You can contact the Samaritans for free. The number is 116123. And the Dublin Samaritans contacted me during the week to say they are 50 years old this weekend. So incredible to think of the number of people they have helped or saved during that time, as the organisation has across the country. And they still need our support. So for more, see samaritans.org. I got a lot of texts in about making your bed. Rose says, no, I don't make my bed. I fold it back, open the window, air the bed in the room. Much more health. Health and wellness, Rose. I love it. Rory says, Claire, it's also great to come home to your made bed. So inviting. Yeah, if I come home to clothes all over the floor and an unmade bed, it's just not the vibe in your room at all. And Marie says, I would miss my train any day before I could leave the house with the bed unmade. I insist on all my kids having their bed made before they come downstairs in the morning. And you know what? That's where it niggles with me more, because I don't make my kids' beds until they get into them. And I think of how beautiful my bed was made by my mum. And they were in the days of sheets and blankets, and she went to the effort. I just have to do a duvet. So yes, must try harder. Right, we'll take a quick break, but coming up, I tried co-boxing, the boxing fitness class, which has taken London by storm. And I asked its Dublin founder, Shane Collins, why he hasn't set up a studio here yet.
Alive and kicking on News Talk.
Thanks to NTC.ie, providing professional qualifications in fitness instruction, chronic myofascial pain, neuromuscular therapy, and Pilates. NTC.ie. See who you can be.
So last weekend, Thrive Festival took place at the Convention Centre in Dublin. It's a health and wellness festival of sorts, so naturally I just had to go. And there are loads of fitness classes and yoga and stuff that you can try. But I was drawn to Co-Box. It's frequented in London by supermodels and pussycat dolls, no less. So I went to see what all the fuss was about and speak to the dub behind it, Shane Collins.
Here's how we teach boxing. There's six basic punches. We number them 1 to 6, and then we'll project them up here. If this works, the magic of technology. So once you learn the six punches, and you can see what's up on the TV screens, you'll know exactly what you're meant to do. In one, Dublin, we're in. First round, let's go. 1-2, 1-2, nice and easy on the bag. And remember, once you hit it, a little like dance away. 1-2, 1-2, away, back in. Nice.
So
I've just completed my Kobox class. We should have had our photo taken, Shane, before I got sweaty. But
we can fix that.
Shane Collins is the man behind it. He is a dub. So what led you to London to have Pussycat Dolls and Models boxing in your class?
Just to have Pussycat Dolls and Models boxing. I moved to London in 2012, almost 2013. And I was working for one of the big, I guess, fitness boutique classes that have kind of done really well called Barry's Bootcamp. And the guy who runs that is a really good friend of mine. So I was in LA before I moved to London. And I guess saw what the whole class concept was in LA, because it was so much more developed. You know, London didn't have anything. So I was there for a couple of years in London, and then I got an opportunity to open my own studio, and that's kind of how Kobox got born.
And why boxing over any other form of exercise?
I came to boxing as a total non-boxer. Never did it before in my life. I played football and I tried to run. That was my thing, and I wasn't really good enough to do either of those. So I guess those who can't do teach is the old saying, and that's probably true for me. So I was coaching athletics mainly more than anything else. And then a friend of mine was a boxer, and he said, you know, would you help me out with my conditioning? Starting with his running, actually, to get better at running and conditioning for boxing. And I loved it. I fell in love with it, but I was probably too old to really start and do anything with it, and not good enough. But I loved the training, and it was amazing. It just blew my mind that people moved in that way, and it was fun. You know, running track, running around in circles isn't the most fun. I just happened to be fast. But when I started boxing training, I absolutely loved it. And then I basically just ended up training boxers for competition on their fitness, their strength and conditioning side of things.
And why is it such a good all-over body workout?
Because it's an all-over, but that's the thing with it, right? Like every punch, everyone thinks boxing's an upper body workout, but every punch comes from the floor. So you're using every muscle in your body to throw a punch. And I think for me, the thing that I noticed was it didn't even feel like training. And that's what I liked about it, was that you're kind of getting your cardio in and you're getting a really intense session. But it's kind of happening without you knowing it, because hitting something that doesn't hit back is fun. So I think that's the bit that did it for me, was being able to do something that almost didn't even feel like you were working out. And I guess the thing with boxing is, if you're not really into boxing, it's hard to find somewhere to go that's not kind of intimidating or scary, because they can be scary places, old school boxing gyms. So I guess that's what we are. We're the boxing club, not for the 1% that are mad into boxing and love those gyms, and I love those gyms. We're for the 99% who probably didn't know how good boxing was as a way of training. We're just putting it in an environment that makes it friendlier for people and more inviting and more fun. So we're kind of taking the fear factor out of boxing and making it fun for people.
And what's the saying that goes around, your fight club meets nightclub?
Yeah.
Because you set it up with the proper booming music, yeah, the disco lights, and it does really add to it.
It's really important. Fear is probably the biggest reason people don't train or work out. And that's not just fear of, like, with boxing, being hit or having to hit someone. It's fear of other people judging you, whether you're too fit, not fit enough, really good boxer, not a good boxer, good at anything. Fear of other people and their opinions really stops people from doing anything. And I always say that if you're out at 2 o'clock in Coppers and you're dancing on the dance, you don't care what anybody thinks of you, because it's kind of really dark, it's loud, no one can really make out who you are, what you're doing. So I guess for us, letting go of your inhibitions is something that everybody tends to do in a nightclub, and we're trying to do that in the fitness world too. So create a space where you can be surrounded by 40 people, you get that group mentality, but you kind of feel like you're in your own space and no one can see you really, and you're able to do your own thing and let your inhibitions go and just have a really fun 50 minutes. And then leave and go about your day.
It's a different bag than I've ever experienced. It's more weighted. It's a bit more bouncy. It looks more like a boy that you might see out at sea than the big long sausage shape. Why that?
That's what it is. Same thing. A boxing bag generally is a big hard thing that people don't really know how to hit. Ours are filled with water. And I guess human beings are mostly water. So it's a more realistic, I guess, target to be hitting. But it's just a bit softer on your joints as well to hit something that's full of water and not full of sand or rags or something like that.
So what's the story now? How many studios have you got in London? And I mentioned some celebrities. What kind of a difference does that make to a business when well-known people with boot and bodies start tagging your fitness class?
Yeah, listen, it's great. I mean, we started with a pop-up in London, because, you know, starting any business is difficult. So we kind of set it up and thought, if this works, we'll do another one, and if it doesn't, then we'll probably be able to pay it back. And yeah, almost straight away, people just start coming, and people said we were mad to do a boxing class, and then we told them that it would be 70% women, and that we'd really be trying to create an environment for women to be able to try boxing and do well, and they said, it's never going to work, you're mental. But almost straight away, and you're right, people always say, like, you know, oh, wouldn't it be great if you got, you know, Katie Taylor down, or we've had Anthony Joshua in, and it's phenomenal, brilliant when they come. But actually, I think people relate more to the celebrities that they might look at and think, oh, I would never have thought they boxed. And if they can do it, I can probably box as well. So that almost has more power. And yeah, you're right, we've been lucky that, you know, London's probably a hotbed for having celebrities in town. And a couple of them have come, and they've been so good at spreading the message for us and getting it out there, because it is important, I guess, when you're starting to, A, no one had ever done a boxing class quite like we had before. So I guess when people see, you know, the people who come on Instagram, or they see it in the Daily Mail or something like that, I think it just makes them feel more comfortable that, well, if they can do it, I can probably do it.
So you'd like to bring it home. You'd like to have a Dublin studio, sure, and possibly elsewhere in Ireland. And what's stopped you?
Certainly not the people. I mean, last year was us dipping our toe into the market to see if people would be interested, and people went mad for it. It was great. We were full last year, we're full this year. It's just finding the right space in Dublin. That's the biggest thing, is where we want to be. Probably just doesn't make that much sense at the minute with rents how they are, but we're looking at sites all the time, and if one came up that we thought made sense, we'd do Dublin in a heartbeat.
Great. Well, I'd be there for another class, Shane. Thank you very, very much.
I've got the picture beforehand this time.
Yeah, please. And a boomerang at the bag. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Of course, you're welcome.
Three light hands. That means you don't hit the bag that hard, but you hit it lots of times. 1-2, 1-2, get away. Straight punches right down the middle. 1-2, 1-2, get away. 1-2, 1-2, get away.
Alive and kicking. On News Talk.
Thanks to NTC.ie, providing professional qualifications in fitness instruction, chronic myofascial pain, neuromuscular therapy, and Pilates. NTC.ie. See who you can be.
And you can text the show 53106. It'll cost you 30 cents. So yes, it is International Women's Day. And while there is always a place for men in our lives, mm-hmm, when women come together, it is a great thing. And I was delighted when Breast Cancer Ireland contacted me and asked if I'd feature a piece today empowering women to take control of their health, to not be embarrassed to ask for help or ask for a breast check. I do think a lot of women suffer in silence, the things that we put up with as just being normal, whether it's to do with our cycle, whether it's to do with putting everybody else first. We do take a hell of a lot on, and we shouldn't always wait until there's a problem before we reach out and look after our health. So I think it's a great message. And to discuss this further, I'm joined by CEO and lady who says she makes her bed every day in relation to our discussion earlier, Breast Cancer Ireland CEO Aisling Hurley, and cancer survivor Emer Craig, who's like me, makes it just before she gets into it, which I think is also an achievement in itself. So Emer, I'll start with you. And you're obviously so much more than a cancer survivor with, you know, who you are in your family, who you are to your friends, what mm-hmm. do you do in your work.
Yes.
But I do think it's a fantastic title to have, because it can't have been an easy road. How do you feel about me referring to you in that way?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting one, because I am a cancer survivor, and I'm very grateful to be a cancer survivor. I feel it's something that wasn't on my plan. I think all of us are aware that cancer is very prominent and that we can get it, but I would have hoped that maybe I'd get a lot later in life if I was going to get it. And you always hope that you'll be the 50% who don't get it. So it's something I didn't want. But on that note, I am grateful. I found a lump. I acted on it straight away. I went to the doctor that day. I went through, it has been an awful journey. I was very lucky. I received an excellent standard of medical care. There was targeted treatment for me, but it was a long road. I had the full works of treatment. It was very difficult. I was out of work for a year, but I am here today. And for the most part, I feel I am getting back to being the person that I was. You'd never be fully the person that you were before, but my energy levels are nearly there. A lot of the times when I'm in work, I'm so busy, I forget about what I went through. And it's like, I sometimes think to myself, did that ever happen? So I am very grateful that I did receive such good care. And I also do feel very lucky. And I just say to myself, thank God I found that lump, because I did find it by accident.
Yeah, because I suppose you don't want to set it up that there's winners or losers.
No,
because everybody's different.
Yeah, everyone's
with their cancer,
different
with their treatment.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was lucky that I did find it. It was a lucky, although it was awful, I do look at that moment I was getting up out of bed. It was a lucky moment in life that I found that, because I wasn't specifically, you know, I was aware of the signs of breast cancer. I would always listen to cancer awareness things because, you know, I've had different cancers in my family, so I know that I always knew cancer could come to anyone. So, but there had been no breast cancer in my family, and you know, I have six aunts and my mom, and nobody has had it. My grandmothers both lived long lives. So, you know, I was of the opinion that maybe breast cancer would only maybe come to someone like me when I was more middle-aged. I didn't think it would come to me at 35.
And you're a primary school teacher, and
yes,
you were just due to go back after the Christmas break. So you had that Sunday evening feeling.
Yes.
And then you found this lump, but you acted on it straight away.
Yes, yeah, I did, yeah. It was actually that Monday morning, the first day back after the Christmas holidays, and I was getting up early to go in, and I had found the lump, and oh my God, you know the way, and I said, look, you know, oh my God, I was like, what is going to happen to me in my life? And I just knew it was in. It wasn't like a prominent lump. It was well in there. You know, I had kind of rolled over in bed. So the first thing, you know, the doctor, I wasn't even sure what to do when you find a lump. I actually, you know, didn't know what to do, but I got through to my doctor, didn't open till 9:30. So I rang them at 9:30, my local GP, and I got an appointment that day for 4 o'clock, you know, so that was the start of my journey. And, you know, she kind of looked at it and not overly concerned, but we said come back, you know, a week later, you know, because I was due to have my cycle. So it could have been hormonal. So then when it was still there, I was referred to James's, and then I was seen within 2 weeks in the breast clinic in St. James's. They were, you know, and then my whole world kind of collapsed in on me.
Which is why some people would nearly put it off. And
because
you don't want to open that door, but it's so important.
It's,
and that's
so
why our message to women is to empower yourself, because the sooner you get moving on it, the sooner you can get the help and support you need.
I think what's the message I want to get across is really, and what is frightening is I was so well. There was absolutely nothing wrong with me. I was fit and healthy. I wasn't feeling sick or particularly tired. It was January. I wasn't feeling any different to how I normally feel. And, you know, I could have, even though when I went through that awful time of that diagnosis, and you're kind of a bit shocked when you're diagnosed, and they're telling you, you know, you have to have chemotherapy, you have to have a surgery, you have to have hormone treatments, you have to have radiotherapy. I was there, and you are a bit in shock, and everyone around me was very upset, you know, the way, because I think it hits them more first. But I was there thinking to myself, and I was grand. All I have is this little lump. I was like, you know, the way, what do you mean I have to have? And then there, and it was, you know, my lymph nodes as well. And I was like, this makes no sense. You're telling me I'm seriously ill, yet I feel grand, you know? So I think it's that we need, I could have kept going for months. In a way, there's a little bit of madness in your mind when you're told this diagnosis. I was like, I should have just said nothing about the lump and just carried on, because I could have carried on for months going to work and being fine. But then it would have all come in on me, and it would have, you know, because I was actually fine at the time of my diagnosis. It was shocking, because I was grand.
And you're empowering not only with that message that you did just get stuck in and do the work that needed to be done, but you're also part of the Breast Health Education and Awareness Programme.
Yeah, that's right.
And you inform teachers of what the signs are.
Well, I was delighted when Breast Cancer Ireland asked me to come on board with that project. And I think with being a teacher, you know, you're used to kind of spreading different messages. And I'm involved in lots of other different things in outside work, you know. So I've always been kind of interested in awareness and so forth. So like, it was a natural progression for me when Aisling asked me to get involved in the education and awareness campaign. So we were delighted, and actually we actually had a breast health awareness talk in my own workplace back in October. We were one of the first to have the breast health for us. That's the one that's organised by Breast Cancer Ireland in my workplace. Yeah.
So we'll bring in CEO of Breast Cancer Ireland, Aisling Hurley, because Aisling, do you think we are breast aware on International Women's Day? Like, even reading up on this for today's interview, there's things I learned, and I'm nearly 42. Why is that? Not just me personally.
Yeah.
Don't try and fix me. But why aren't we as breast aware as maybe we should be?
I think as a nation, we like to shelve things. We don't like to really talk about it. I think it's, you know, if trouble isn't knocking on your door, don't ask for it. And I think when we have done conversations with women, and about 5 years ago, we set up our free to download app called BreastAware. The reason behind that was of the women that we brought together between the ages of 20 and 50, you know, 90% were saying, oh, yeah, we're very breast aware. We know what breast cancer is. We don't necessarily check ourselves regularly and we're not 100% sure how to do it properly. Plus, we always thought it was a lump. We didn't have any idea that there was, you know, 8 signs and symptoms to look for. And I think from that, that became the stark reality that people are not breast aware.
And what change have you seen in the world of cancer since you took over as CEO of Breast Cancer Ireland?
Well, one of the significant things, so we started Breast Cancer Ireland in 2012, and I, at the time, spoke to our chairman, who's the leading breast surgeon, and I said, you know, will we find a cure in my lifetime? The problem is we won't, because there are a gazillion permutations of breast cancer. Every single diagnosis is particularly, it's personal and tailored to that individual. And we've learned that over the years through the research that we've done with various blood and protein. So now I'm saying, well, okay, if I can't find a cure in my lifetime, can I certainly transform it from being sometimes fatal, because we do have 690 deaths annually, into a treatable long-term illness? And how can I get there? And one of the key things is we've 8 designated cancer centres around the country, but we worked in silos, typical Irish style. You know, we don't want the other cancer centre to know what I'm doing for fear they'll take the intelligence that I'll produce. So one of the things we said was, well, as Breast Cancer Ireland, could we recruit specialist breast research nurses, put them in these 8 designated cancer centres and make them collaborate and collate all the breast cancer tissue samples into a large national biobank that everybody can have access to for their own particular form of research. So, for instance, 8-10 years ago, each centre might have produced 1 peer-reviewed publication in about 18 or 24 months. Today, each centre is producing between 9 and 12 publications annually. So we have massively sped up discovery rates, which is fantastic, because once we have a publication produced, we go on into clinical trial and then into pharmaceutical production.
It is incredible work that you're doing. And I was at your breakfast meeting for World Cancer Day not so long ago, and to hear surgeons speak and the research team and the work that is going on and the human impact it's having is incredible, as Emer is testament here. Mm-hmm. But you need fundraising. You need people's help. So with that in mind, you have me dancing the Paso Doble on the 4th of April. This is a big fundraiser for Breast Cancer Ireland. Battle of the Stars.
Battle of the Stars. The Battle of the Stars is now in its 7th year, which is phenomenal, where we bring together personalities, survivors, supporters of breast cancer, and they 9 times out of 10 don't know how to dance. So we try to teach them how to dance over an 8-week period, and then they become part of the entertainment piece for about an hour as part of a gala ball that we host every year in April. It's a good fundraiser, but it's also a great profile raiser for Breast Cancer Ireland. And it's a fantastic opportunity to bring our patient ambassadors on board in this journey.
Well, hopefully I don't let you down. I'm practicing as best I can. It is on in the Clayton and Bulls Bridge on April 4th. And about that, other fundraisers and other information, go to breastcancerireland.com and download that app. Get Breast Aware. I just think it's really, really important.
Absolutely.
Get checked. If you're in about your big toe or your kids' tonsils, ask for a breast check. It's nothing to be embarrassed about if you're in the GPs anyway. Yeah. And I think we need to talk about that all the more.
And yes. One other thing, though, we also have a free complimentary service, like Emer was saying, that we give to all the schools. So we started with TY classes and we now have introduced it across primary school teachers, secondary school teachers, corporates and communities, where we go out with six education researchers that go, coordinators that travel the country to go to all these schools, giving this good breast health presentation with a medical mannequin, showing people how to look after their breast health. We've met about 40,000 women in 5 years in a partnership with Cornmarket and the INTO, and 4 have been early diagnoses as a result. So this is a free service, and I really would urge the public, if they're in schools or community groups or large groups of women, to get in touch. We will facilitate you.
Amazing. So you're back to work and feeling well, Emer?
Yeah, I went back. I'm back over a year now, and it's great because I'm a primary school teacher, so the children keep you busy, and it's entertaining. Every day is different.
It can't be about you.
And sometimes I do just stand back and I say to myself, oh my God, I'm so lucky, because there was so long with treatment that I was just sitting at home, and you never think you're going to get your life back. And I just think to myself, oh my God, even like simple things, like the other day we brought children to the art gallery and I was just like, this is just so wonderful. And amazing. I'm just, every little thing is wonderful.
Well, if that's not an empowering message on International Women's Day, I don't know what is. Thank you very, very much.
Thank
CEO
you.
Of Breast Cancer Ireland, Aisling Hurley and Emer Craig.
Thank you
Claire. Very much. And thanks to my producer, John Fardy, and Jojo Cardoza was on sound. Vincent Wall is up next. Have a good Sunday.
Your brand deserves better than one-size-fits-all branded clothing. Lands' End Outfitters creates apparel your team will want to wear. Backed by above and beyond expertise, go to business.landsend.com/pod20 and use code POD20 for 20% off your first product.